Go ahead and turn back over to Romans chapter 1. You might just put your marker there. We'll be spending our time primarily in this chapter this morning. But I need to begin by telling you of an observation that I have been making. And I'm fearful of this observation because I'm afraid it means that I'm turning into a grouchy old man. You have to watch those things at this point in your life. But I've noticed that as I go to places, especially fast food places, no one says thank you anymore. Have you noticed that? You go in and you order and you pay, and it might be have a nice day. That's okay. But I've noticed that sometimes I end up being the one thanking the employee with the response of, no problem. Now, contrast that with the owner of a business. When you go into a business and when the owner of that business waits on you and you pay, you know what you receive? Not just a thank you, but a heartfelt thank you. What's the difference? Well, I would suggest to you that both of those groups have a certain knowledge. If you were to ask that typical fast food waiter, waitress, server, and you were to say, do you realize that if customers stop coming here, you'll go out of business? Probably that worker would say, yeah, I know. If you ask that same question to the owner will say, absolutely, I know that. What's the difference? They both have knowledge. Both of them have the same understanding, but one of them understands the consequences. Whereas the fast food worker, if that job goes away, there's another one waiting. There's another fast food place down the road that will hire them. If the owner of that business goes out of business, he or she understands that livelihood has gone away. Now, with that illustration, I want you to look at verse 21 of Romans chapter 1. The apostle is speaking here of those who do not know God in the way he's going to describe. But let's look at what he says when he says, for although they knew God. Strong word that he uses here. They have this knowledge. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Now here's a situation where the apostle is saying they know God, but that knowledge does not equate into honoring God or thanking God. In our theme this year, we're talking about being partakers of the divine nature. And as Peter talks about that, he says, add to your faith virtue and to virtue knowledge. And last Sunday morning, Carl gave a very informative lesson on that knowledge. So which is Peter talking about in our scenario this morning? If we were to compare our knowledge and the consequences of it to our illustration, which are we more like? Are we like the fast food worker who, yeah, I know? Or are we like the owner of that business who says, I well understand the consequences? Because here the apostle is saying, you can have knowledge, but you can have a knowledge that just simply does not go far enough. And so this morning I want to talk about not being that kind of person. To be a person not only of knowledge, but having a knowledge that does not stop there, but yet takes us to where it needs to be. And as the apostle says, you're going to know that by your attitude toward honoring and thanking God. So let's talk about Romans chapter 1 for just a minute as we kind of set the stage here. And as the apostle leads into this with the passage that Stephen has just read to us, he's talking about what he desires to do and what he would like to impart to them. And he says to them, there's some things you need to know. And what we want to look at primarily as we introduce this is verses 16 and 17, where he talks about the standard that God has established. So verse 16, he says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Now following right up with that, verse 17, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Here's the standard. Here's the apostle saying, this is what you've got to have. This is what you must understand. And then in chapter 1 following, he says, here are the reasons people fail in this standard. Here are the reasons that although people have knowledge, that they don't get to the point that God desires of them. And therefore, that's going to set up an argument that the apostle will make for knowing God. And the first thing he's going to tell us is, everybody should know there is a God. And the point he's going to make by the time he gets to the end is that there is no excuse for not knowing God. So how do we know it? Oftentimes we talk about those people who've never been exposed to Christianity, those people who in some deep, dark African tribe or South American tribe have never gotten the knowledge. The apostle answers that. He says the way that you can know God is from creation. Look at his point in verses 19 and 20. He says, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. How? For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So here is the apostle makes the argument. He says, look, you can know God by creation. That's the point the Bible has been making almost since the first chapter. Think about just two or three examples of that with me. Psalm 19, perhaps the best example, where the psalmist says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims His handiwork. We think a little further. We think about what we're told in Psalm 143. The psalmist says, I remember the days of old. I meditate on all that You have done. What? I ponder the works of Your hands. You think about what Isaiah said. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens, who stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. Here are all of the examples that the apostle is using as well with the Romans. The psalmist Isaiah has said you can know God. Let me show you one other. This one a little bit more lengthy, but taken from the book of Job as we look at Elihu, who kind of comes on the scene after this back and forth exchange with Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, as they're trying to convince Job he's a rotten guy and Job is fighting back. Listen to what Elihu says concerning God. He says, remember to extol His work of which men have sung. All mankind has looked on it. Behold it from afar. Behold, God is great and we know Him not. The number of His years is unsearchable. For He draws up the drops of water. They distill His mist and rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thundering of His pavilion? Behold, He scatters His lightning about Him and covers the roots of the seas. For by these He judges peoples. He gives food in abundance. He covers His hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares His presence. The cattle also declare that He rises. What a beautiful passage. You know, much of the book of Job is very, very true if it wasn't in the context that it was in. Many of the things the three friends say about God are absolutely right. They're applying them in the wrong way. And whatever opinion you take of Elihu's role in the book of Job, what he says here is right. Here is God revealed in nature. Here is God revealed in the things that He does. But I believe the apostle also alludes to one other way that we know God. It's not only in creation. Paul is also saying you can know Him from the workings of history. You can watch what's been going on from the creation of the world. I like what Schiller said when he stated, the history of the world is the judgment of the world. We look historically at mankind and we see what's been expected and we've seen the outcome when a group obeys God and when a group disobeys God. And therefore the apostle is saying to us, look, because you can see God in creation and because you can see God in history, there is absolutely no excuse for not knowing it. There is absolutely no excuse for saying, I have no knowledge of the Lord. And that's the point there at the end of verse 20. So they are without excuse. Now, when we consider that, we must understand what the apostle is leading to. He's going to say to us that if you do not know God, there's going to come a point when you're going to face His wrath. There's going to come a point when you will have to answer to Him for the things that have been done. Anders Nygren had this to say. He said, as long as God is God, He cannot behold with indifference that His creation is destroyed and His holy will trodden underfoot. Therefore, He meets sin with His might and an annihilating reaction. Yes, it's exactly right. For those who have the opportunity, which is all of mankind, to know God, and they choose not to pursue that knowledge of God, destruction is coming. Now, Paul is going to say that's going to lead to a dead end in several ways. His verdict is, if you ignore this knowledge of God, if you reject this knowledge of God, it's going to be seen in what you choose to do instead of following after Him. And so here in chapter 1, he talks about the dead ends that one's going to reach. And what's so interesting about chapter 1, as you'll note in verse 23 beginning, and we'll see this two more times, the apostle is going to say, and they exchanged. Interesting idea. Here is the knowledge of God, but because I don't want that knowledge, I take it and I exchange it for this dead end. And the first dead end exchange the apostle talks about is that of idolatry. Let's continue on here. We're going to pick up verse 21 again and read down through 23. He says, for although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Here we find what God has been warning against year after century after millennia. He says, don't trade me in for an idol. That is a dead end. That is a rejection of the knowledge of God. And so God says, such as in Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 16, He says, I will declare my judgments against them for all their evil in forsaking me. They have made offerings to other gods and worshiped the work of their own hands. And so here is mankind who's indicted, man who has the opportunity to know God from creation and history, and he trades him in. If it were not so serious, Isaiah would have a most amusing passage on idolatry. I don't know, it's print's a little small here, but Isaiah 44, verses 14 through 19, he says this, he cuts down cedars. He's talking about the idolater here. That's who's under consideration. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak, and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar, and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes an idol and falls down before of it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meat. He roasts and is satisfied. Also he warms himself and says, aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burned in the fire, I also baked bread on its coals, I roasted meat and have eaten, and shall fall down, and shall I make the rest of it an abomination, shall I fall down before a block of wood? You see the irony here? God provides the tree, God provides the rain, God provides the nourishment, and the man enjoys all of that, and the other half of the piece of wood he turns into an idol and says, "Thank you, idol, for all you've given to me." God says, "I'll close his eyes if he's got that. I'll not let him see me because I've given him opportunity. I've given him occasion, but he's chosen this dead end instead." The apostle continues on. He says another dead end that leads to that idolatry is the denial of the truth. Look at verse 25. He says, because they exchanged, our second use of the term, the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. On this occasion, the apostle says, what they knew of God, they rejected. And that kind of takes us back to verse 18. Where in verse 18, the apostle is talking about those who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Though the truth is there, they've chosen not to see it. They've chosen not to look upon it. And because of that, they've turned God into something that He's not. Referencing verse 23 again. They've served the creature rather than the Creator. So here we find occasion that rather than learning from creation and seeing the God of creation and learning from history and seeing the God of history, they have rejected that truth that's led them in a very wrong direction. His third dead end, he says, what they've done is they've taken up unnatural practices. You look at 26, the second part of that verse. Here's our third use of the exchange. For their women exchange natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. For they were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Look at that list. The apostle says what you have done is you have traded God in for things that go against the nature of man. Therefore, he uses homosexuality to illustrate that point. What a perfect point to use. Because what's the lesson he's been teaching all along here? The lesson is God has shown you what's right. Jesus uses that very argument when talking about marriage. He says in 19, verses 4 and 5 of Matthew, "Have you not read that he who created from the beginning made them male and female, and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." You know what Jesus is saying? He's saying from the creation, God has shown you all about men and women and male and female and marriage. From the creation, you've known that. But in their rejection of the knowledge of God, they have taken the oldest of human relationships and they've changed that when they deny who the Creator is and choose not to have knowledge of Him. Wouldn't it be nice to say all of these things died away in the first century? That Christianity thrived and men changed and they came to know God, but we know that's not the case. And we think about today all of the different things where we see mankind in a most uncreative way following the same dead ends that these people in the first century were following. We're living in a time where materialism has become our idol. We may not chop half a piece of wood off and worship it, but we see people worshiping stuff just like those idols. We see where now it is mainstream to say that if you believe in the Creator God, you are obviously ignorant and unlearned. And here we have a form of belief that will take us to say that you are not the product of God. You are not fearfully and wonderfully made. Instead, you are the result of some cosmic accident that occurred that led to all of these things to making you what you are today. We see agnostics who take pride in the fact of saying, my God is ignorance. I don't know if there's one or not, and so I'm going to tolerate everything. What would Paul say if he was living in 2016 and watched the news about nations declaring homosexual marriage legal? And people saying, we don't need to decide on genders. Each person needs to decide if it's male or female when it gets some knowledge. What's happened? It's dead ends. The same thing the apostle talked about in the first century is still sadly going strong when people say, I will not accept the God of the creation. I will not accept the God of history. And because of that, off they go into all of these different directions. We cannot allow that to happen to our faith. And thus the apostle is going to say to us, you must avoid those dead ends because God has given you the direction you need to go. And so what the apostle says is there's an alternative to all of this. All of this foolishness of worshiping wood, of homosexuality, of denying the truth, and that is finding God. That's the answer. However, we must understand that while God is revealed in creation and God is revealed in knowledge, that knowledge alone is insufficient. We're not there. We're not to the point of, in a sense, taking ownership of what that means for us. Maybe we can illustrate it somewhat like this. Here we have this knowledge of a God of creation and we see workings through history. But that knowledge does not bring us to the point where we can give Him honor and thanksgiving. So, what's the solution to all of this? Well, that's where the apostle is going to take the book of Romans. He's going to say that there is a way of getting to that point, and that's by what God has revealed. I tell you, we alluded to Psalm 19 earlier. I think that is probably one of, if not the best place in the entire Bible to make this point. You remember the first half of the chapter? God is revealed in nature. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament declares His handiwork. And he talks about the God of nature. And then about halfway through the psalm, what? The law of the Lord is perfect and clean and righteous. More to be desired than gold. More to be desired than the honey of the honeycomb. What's he saying? He's saying, I see the God of creation, but I got to know more about Him. And the way I know more about Him is in what He's revealed to me. Now, let me tell you, if someone living under the law of Moses can say, the law is precious to me, how much more should we be saying that who see the revealed Word in its completeness, in its entirety? Now, I'd like to make a point here, if I may. This is where we part company with those who are intelligent design theorists. Let me make this point. I have benefited greatly from people who are intelligent design advocates. Some of the best writing against the Darwinian idea that there is no force out there is done by this group. But here's where I have to part company with them. Because for many of them, their idea simply says something, somewhere, somehow created us. We're not the products of a cosmic collision. Something out there created us. Maybe it's God. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's the force. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's the spirit. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's just this eternal something or other out there that we're going to become part of. We don't know. Yes, we do. Because that bridge that takes us from a knowledge of a higher power in creation will take us to the honor and the thanksgiving that He is due because of who He is. Therefore, when I know God, that means I'm going to be able to honor Him. You see, that's a test. If I'm just at a point of saying there's something out there and I don't know what it is, I'm not going to give that something any honor. I'm just acknowledging it. I'm saying, yes, I've come to appreciate that something is out there. When I learn that something is someone and that someone is God, it is then that the honor comes. It's the same idea that we find in the word glorify. And so here is the apostle saying to us, look, you're able to recognize him for who he is. You're able to recognize that he is not just some unnamed force. He is God. How do I know I'm there? It's going to be reflected in my worship. Where do we show glory to God? Where do we show honor to God? Well, we could answer that question and say, it's certainly in our actions, in our attitudes. But where it is displayed is when we come before Him in worship. And if I do not have that full knowledge of what God has revealed to me, I cannot worship Him. I cannot honor Him in the fullest sense. Think about something Jesus told us. When he said, well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me, here's our term, this people glorifies, they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Why can they not honor God? They don't know Him. They've not taken what God has said about Himself and brought that into their knowledge. Instead, they've tried to define God by what they believe. God hasn't impacted their knowledge. Their knowledge has impacted their view of who God actually is. And thus, when I worship, I must understand that if I don't have that knowledge of God, it's not going to honor Him. So, worship is going to provide insight, very personally, into my attitude concerning God. If my worship is wholehearted, if my worship is given in a spiritual way with God's honor in mind, I'm getting it. If my worship is vain and lip service only, I've still got very much a ways to go on this. So how do I know? Well, I think there's two ways. Jesus said those who worship will worship in spirit and in truth. Remember, He was talking to the Samaritan woman who was worshiping incorrectly, and He was saying to her, there is a right way to worship, and you're not doing it. Am I concerned about that? Am I concerned about finding the right way? If my standard is, it really doesn't matter what we do, as long as we're sincere, I don't have it. It's not honor. You don't honor someone by ignoring what they've told you to do and replacing your will for theirs. So am I concerned about that? Does my attitude reveal a spirit of reverence? That's the second question. Those who worship are going to worship in spirit, a reverential way. You're not going to have to go to the temple anymore. You're not going to have to find some special place. You can worship wherever you are, because you recognize who God is. And so that if that's in a collective assembly, as we're commanded to do, to come together, to remember the death of Christ, to sing together, to pray together, I'm reverencing that. If it's my individual, private worship, I'm being reverential. That's how I know. How do I know if I'm coming to the knowledge of God? Worship is going to give me pretty good insight into that. But secondly, Paul says full knowledge is going to bring thanksgiving. And I'll just have to confess to you, I don't know, before I started preparing this lesson, if I had ever just sat down and thought about the connection between knowledge and thanksgiving. But it's amazing. You start looking throughout the Bible and you see that connection. It's common sense, isn't it? That we're not going to be thankful unless we know why we're thankful. And thus, this is an indicator of whether or not I really am coming to know God by viewing my thanksgiving toward Him. Let's look at a definition. I don't know who came up with this, but I think it's exactly right. Thankfulness defined, it's seeing the goodness of another as it is expressed in real benefit. When do you thank someone? you thank someone, if you're doing it honestly, when that person has done something for you. And you recognize the someone, and you recognize the something. That might be something very small. You got one item at the grocery store. And here's somebody with three buggyfuls, and they're in front of you. And that person says, "Would you like to go in front of me?" What do we do? Thank you so much. Why? Here's somebody doing something very nice. Well, let's take that on the other side. Thanklessness then would be what? It's receiving the benefit with no acknowledgement of the provider. You ever done something really, really nice for someone and they just completely ignored it? We don't do nice things to have thanksgiving heaped upon us, but every one of us knows how that feels. Where you have gone out of your way to do something kind for someone, and it's kind of a shrug of the shoulders, and we know what thanklessness is. Therefore, when I come to a full knowledge of God, thanklessness is not going to be any part of me. I'll be in no way associated with it because my life will become that of thanksgiving. So it's time for a test. As I consider my attitude about thanksgiving to God, where does it fall? Well, if I'm like the folks that Paul was describing in Romans 1, it's absolutely absent. Let's do a little comparison here. Another word for thanklessness, I would say, is being ungrateful, wouldn't you? You're not grateful to someone. You're not acknowledging that. Look at two times that word ungrateful is used in the New Testament. Luke chapter 6, verse 35, talking about the Lord here, Jesus says, "But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He is kind to the ungrateful and evil." That's the vast majority of the world throughout history. God has revealed Himself in nature. God's revealed Himself in history. He's been ignored. No pursuit of more knowledge of Him. People accept His gifts, which He provides, but they accept it in a very thankless way. And so Jesus says, while you're on this earth, imitate that. Whether someone's good to you or bad to you, be kind. Whether they're grateful or not, be kind to them, because that's what God does. But look at the second time the word is used. As the apostle is writing to Timothy, he says in 2 Timothy 3, talking about people in the latter days, people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful. Paul is saying, though the Lord has blessed people who are not thankful, one of the characteristics that shows how far you are from God is the fact that you will give Him no thanks for what's been provided. I always love reading the list of Paul, don't you? When he just gets on a roll and he starts adding all these different characteristics. Look what's surrounding this. Lovers of self, lovers of money. That's idolatry, isn't it? Proud, arrogant. That's the idea of exchanging the truth. Abusive, disobedient to their parents. That's going against the ways that have been established from creation. Here it is all over again. What Paul told the Romans, he told Timothy, beware and be careful. But it may be that my worship isn't absent, because I realize that those who have worship that's absent are going to face the wrath of God. Maybe it's the fact that I do give some acknowledgement to God, but my worship, my thanksgiving is just stagnant. I think it'd be reminiscent of what Jesus said about the Gentiles and the way they worship their pagan gods. He said, "When you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words." Sometimes thanksgiving can become that way. That in our prayers, we get so much in a rut that we are speaking thanksgiving. "Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for your kind blessings. Thank you for watching over us." All those are great things to pray for. But if those are empty phrases, I'm in no better shape than the pagan Gentile. My worship must be authentic. My thanksgiving to God must be more than some tired old song that I know the words, and I can sing it without even thinking about it. If my thanksgiving to God is that way, I don't know Him. But if my thanksgiving is what it needs to be, because my knowledge is what it needs to be, my worship will be overflowing. Paul was in a very odd situation. There were people who wanted to worship him as one of the gods that had come down from heaven. A lot of men would have fallen to that temptation. The Apostle Paul immediately says, stop what you're doing. But I want you to notice something he says about God as he's doing that. This is in Acts chapter 14, beginning in verse 15. He says, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, creation. Right? So you know God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that walk in it. You know Him from history. In past generations, He allowed the nations to walk in their own ways. How do you know Him? Yet He did not leave Himself without witness, for He did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. I bring this passage out because it's so typical of the Apostle Paul. Another thing I love about his writings is the Apostle Paul is going along. As I've mentioned before, he has really no use for periods in his sentences. He's going along with this thought, and all of a sudden he mentions Jesus Christ, and immediately the writing changes, and he starts talking about the greatness of God and the greatness of Jesus Christ. That's a man who's overflowing with thanksgiving, who cannot help himself but to say when something comes along, here is an occasion to thank God, hang on a minute, because I'm going to. Does that describe us? Are we people who are so full of the knowledge of God that it's just kind of like this volcano, it's just waiting. And whenever the opportunity comes, whether that's at a meal, whether that's when God blesses us congregationally, whether that's whether something good has happened to me personally, whether God has allowed me to learn from a trial in my life, I cannot help but thank Him. That's when I know God. So our question is, do I have that knowledge? In summing all of this up, I think Psalm 100 gives us a very good idea. When the psalmist says, enter into His gates with thanksgiving and into His courts with praise, be thankful to Him and bless His name, for the Lord is good and His mercy is everlasting. Does that describe your attitude toward God? Does that describe the God that has given everything so that you can have salvation? This morning it may be in your life that you are there, but you've not made the commitment that you need to. You know God more than just a creation historical knowledge. You know Him from the revealed Word. And you know that one thing He has said is, if you want to be saved from your sins, you're to be baptized, washing away those sins, showing the faith necessary, raised up to walk with Him. Are you ready to do that this morning? To go from a knowledge that is inactive, a knowledge that's leading to a dead end, to a knowledge that's going to put you into the appropriate action and response to the Lord. Now's the time to do that. Or maybe you did that at one time, but that knowledge has faded. And now you find that you are not standing with Him. God will welcome you back. And if you would like for us to pray with you this morning, we'll do that. There'll be no judgment from us about that. Because every Christian here has gone through those times when faith was difficult and weak. And I imagine every one of us knows the encouragement that you get from brethren. We'll go to the throne room of God with you. Whatever it takes this morning, let's make sure that we're becoming that partaker of the divine nature by adding to our faith virtue and knowledge.